the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, the opposition not happy with changes to the Department of Regional Development, and also one of the most modern and high-tech farming methods may soon help Indigenous farmers bring some of Australia's oldest surviving plants into the mainstream.
One of the professors were actually going into the native community in Canada because the knowledge that they had on food and medicine was getting lost, because the shaman were disappearing and all this knowledge for curing disease were getting lost because the generation, you know, was not passed on.
All that and a whole lot more coming up on the program. And you can always send us a text, 0467 922 684. Some changes at Murray Irrigation as well with the board there. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first to politics. The National Party are unhappy about the rebranding of the Department of Regional New South Wales, saying it will be gobbled up in a few months' time by the DPI. From July the 1st, it'll be known as the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. The state government says the reasons for the latest rebranding is to put a greater focus on agriculture, biosecurity, fisheries and forestry. But New South Wales Nationals leader Dugald Saunders says he thinks it's the Premier, Chris Minns, trying to centralise control, which is bad for people in the bush.
Well, let's call this what it is, Michael, and that is Minns and his ministers taking funding and resources away from the regions. That's the very simple takeaway point of view that we've got here. It's disappointing for not just me and people that I happen to know, but people right across regional New South Wales are not happy. We know we deserve the same services as people in the city, and what we've seen is Labor now reversing years of hard work by the New South Wales Nationals in government and people in the Department of Regional New South Wales who have made it their life's work to try and improve the way that people can interact with government in regional areas. And you're right, I heard the interview with the Minister for Regional New South Wales, and to be quite honest, I was shocked. I mean, basically everything she said failed to answer a question, including the suggestion there'll be no cost. I mean, to suggest there's no cost in completely reorganising a department and rebranding it is completely ridiculous. It will have a cost, of course it will, but it's not just about the cost. It's about everything that changes within the department to make it a more centralised department and take away the resources and the management from regional areas of New South Wales.
So you think there will be cuts, you think jobs will be lost, you think that services will be cut?
Look, definitely jobs will be lost, and definitely there will be cost around this change of name and possible direction. I mean, we've already been told,
even though the ministers did say the budget won't be slashed.
Yeah, well, she made it very clear the budget will not change, but that doesn't mean that there's no more costs involved in what they're doing. So does that mean there'll be jobs cut? Well, she refused to answer that, and I think that's fairly concerning. So there might be the same budget, but it means they have to drop maybe 100 staff, because we've heard there's already 106 or up to 110 maybe jobs on the line, and that's in the first tranche. We've already seen plenty of jobs already starting to shift. I mean, I know personally of a few people that have been told their contracts will not be renewed at the end of June, including in the former Department of Regional Youth. So, you know, we know there are job cuts coming. We talked about that over a couple of weeks ago. So people know that their futures are on the line, and, you know, if you remove 100 jobs, well, that probably saves you a couple of million dollars. Well, therefore you can go and rebrand and do that stuff. But
yeah, but maybe she's going to shift jobs back into Department of Primary Industries away from regional development, regional services.
Well, the new department allegedly is called the Department of Primary Industries and Regional Development. So you need to have a focus on both of those. And regional development, as we know, is extremely important, as is DPI. So I think the idea of combining them into, you know, one name to try and show that they're of equal importance, okay, that's fine. But don't pretend there will be no changes to how things are done. And even cost-wise, we heard in the interview, and we heard it at Budget Estimates, that there'll be a couple of senior roles as opposed to one senior role, Well, that will cost more money. I mean, you have to remove people from other roles to create roles at a certain level, the highest level, to be able to pay them where there was one person previously. So I just think it's all smoke and mirrors. The clear thing is the minister won't answer questions directly about any job cuts that are possibly coming. And her way of dealing with things is to bury her head and just answer separate questions than what she's being asked. But people don't believe that. When you've got a bad feeling about the way someone's answering questions, it's normally because they're trying to hide something. What is she trying to hide? It's job cuts, and that's almost certain.
And you think that maybe she's doing the bidding of somebody else, like Minns's office, or maybe Penny Sharp, who's maybe the power behind the throne in the Labor government?
Well, look, what we heard during budget estimates and then again in her interview is that Scott Hanson, the former Director General of DPI, was removed by Rebecca Fox, who's the current secretary, about to be removed by the minister.
And the minister said she wasn't happy with that decision and didn't know about it prior to that happening.
Which is completely ridiculous again. As I've said to you before, how can the minister not be aware of the top civil servant in the Department of Primary Industries being removed? I mean, that is beyond belief. And she's now proved it by saying she's the one who removed Rebecca Fox, who, by the way, is the one person who has stood with her for the past year, done a couple of budget estimates, taken everything on the chin for the minister, and now she's been the one let go as well. I mean, it is hard to believe that that is factual. And what we know is that everything is being centralised back through the Premier's department. That's the idea of this. There'll be one secretary who is directly reporting to the Premier's office. It's not through the Deputy Premier as it's been formerly, where regional areas have a focus through that department. This is heading straight back to the Premier's office based in Sydney. And you've got to remember, this is the guy that during the election campaign said, I don't pretend to know anything or have any idea or any expertise in regional New South Wales. Well, we know that. It's Sydney-centric, and this is a huge concern for everyone in regional New South Wales.
Or is it that Chris Minns wants to keep the primary industries portfolio in his control until he hands it over back to Steve Wan?
Well, look, there's possible scenarios around every corner, isn't there? And I think it's fair to say that Minns is centralising everything back to his department so he can continue to be puppet master. And I'm sure he's got very capable people within his Premier's department. That's not what this is about. This is about understanding, living and breathing regional areas. When you live in a regional area, you understand what people are thinking and feeling. That's the point of it. That's how you have best representation.
You need good judgment. You need good advice.
Absolutely you do, and you can only get that if you've got people living there and working there and raising families there. If you don't have that, you're kidding yourself.
New South Wales Nationals leader Dugald Saunders there. It's 13 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Australia's largest private irrigation company, Murray Irrigation, is looking for new directors after months of disunity on the board. The company delivers water to irrigators around 740,000 hectares in the Southern Riverina and was facing a $7 million loss this financial year. But the sale of temporary water has turned that around into a small profit. There has been a concern about the company's management. Three member directors were forced to resign after they unsuccessfully brought a vote to remove two independent board members earlier this month. Murray Irrigation Chairman Phil Snowden told Emily Doak he hopes filling the positions on the board will allow it to move forward.
We need to fill a minimum of two to get the board back up to the minimum of six directors in accordance with our constitution, but we can have more than that. We can have a board of up to nine. So we're particularly looking for shareholder director nominations, but we can take an external one as well. We're particularly looking for diversity on the board, so more women and also the younger generation of farmers, if we can find people that can allow the time to take on a director's position, so we get that greater diversity.
And what is the process if people put their hat in the ring and nominate by this Friday, as you say? What happens from there on?
So what we've done, we've set up an independent selection committee, which has got Robbie Sefton, Managing Director of Sefton's, on it, Chris Kelly, Director and Chairman of KM&W Kelly & Sons in Finlay, and also Jenny Grigg, who's a founder of Blink Connect. and a director of that organisation. So people who understand our area and also understand the company and where it's positioned within the footprint.
So you want to fill these positions so that you've got enough, I suppose, bodies on the board to be able to make decisions for the company to move forward. When will shareholders, I suppose, get an opportunity to vote on the makeup of the board next?
We're filling casual vacancies as they exist at the moment, and the shareholders will vote on those positions at this year's AGM. So that's their chance to endorse the process that we've gone through. If they don't like the candidates, they can vote them off and we'd have to start all over again.
The need for this has come about because of some disharmony and disunity within the previous board. There were attempts to remove the non-member directors, and as a subsequent of that failing, other shareholder members, three other shareholder members resigned from the board. I suppose, how do you move forward from that when there's been such a split and a period of disquiet that's engulfed the organisation for some months now?
If we get the right mix of directors and improve our communication with our shareholders and our customers, there's no reason why it shouldn't move forward and be quite successful. We certainly have a lot of challenges within our footprint as a result of the recovery of water from the basin plan and significant reduction in available water now for our shareholders. So we're basically delivering half the water now as what we were at privatisation. So we have those challenges, but if we get the right mix of people on the board, and that's why we're particularly focused on trying to get some of the next generation of farmers onto the board, so we work through what it looks like for the company going forward.
There's been concern about things such as the use of conveyance water, the sale of excess conveyance water, and some of the measures taken to, I suppose, repair the budget or bring the budget back into the black, and the way that the water sales were handled. Also things in terms of, I suppose, some corporate governance issues. Have they been addressed? Are you able to sort of move past that, or is that going to form part of this review once a new board's in place?
You're always reviewing those sort of things, without a doubt. And they're part of the challenges that we have when you're delivering less water than what we used to. So the business model that we've landed on, commercialising some of the efficiency that we've delivered out of PIOP and the conveyance water that we have as a result of that, but that's just part. That's part of the mix.
The business model settled on commercialising some of those savings, as you say, that have been made in efficiency over the years, and doing that in a temporary water sales rather than permanent water sales. Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
What's your assessment as chairman as to how that process panned out in the last financial year?
It's worked out okay. It's a balancing act. We've certainly had some feedback from shareholders who say don't commercialise any water and just put the fees and charges up. But by the same token, we've got other shareholders who are really struggling with paying their fixed charges against their DEs when they're not using water against them because the water's been sold off of farms by, you know, previous owners and that sort of thing. So it is a really big challenge in front of us.
That's Murray Irrigation's chairman, Phil Snowden, speaking there with Emily Doak. It's 18 minutes past 12. You might have some thoughts about that story or other stories on the program. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
One of the most modern and high-tech farming methods may soon bring some of Australia's oldest surviving plants into the mainstream. It's all part of the long-term plan for Indigenous-owned company Boomer Food and its indoor vertical farm in Cessnock in the New South Wales Hunter Valley. ABC News Newcastle's reporter Lillian Watkins drove out to the farm to find out a little bit more.
The Boomer Food operation is about an hour drive out of Newcastle in the regional town of Cessnock, but that's about where the similarities with it and traditional farming stop. On the 12-acre property, a huge but relatively unremarkable 2,000-metre-squared shed sits. Inside, large shipping containers line the perimeter. And inside those, Thousands of little plants grow on thin rotating trays under fluorescent pink lights in something reminiscent of a farm in a sci-fi movie. The system is fully automated, with each container programmed to emit the perfect amount of water, nutrients, light and temperature at exactly the right time for each plant species. Finding this cubic farm technology has taken Boomer Food founder and Kamilaroi man Corey Robertson 10 years, but he says it was well worth the wait.
What we're using is the cubic farm technology. We have seed germination machines we call propagators. We put our seeds in these substrates, little substrates which mimic soil, etc. So we put our seeds in there. Effectively, we're getting those seeds to go from seed to seedling a lot more quickly and reliably. So within a period of, say, 14 days to 18 days. Herbs are 14 days and lettuce are about 18 days. Then we put them in a cultivator. In the same period of time, you have a finished product. And what you have is, in those machines, which you would have seen from the footage, is crop motion going up and back. From front to back, it's about a 2.5 to 4 hour journey. And every 2.5, 4 hours, they're getting a dose of liquid nutrition, which is all biodegradable. The only thing that ever gets wet is the roots. Therefore, we're getting more productivity, and we're also using less water. In fact, 95% less water. So outside that, when it's all said and done, our propagation machines can take anywhere from 65 to 90,000 seedlings, which then go and feed our cultivators. But also outside that, we can't grow everything inside these cubic farms. We see a play there that we can deal with other First Nations groups or other supply chain growers that need to get some seedlings, so we can propagate them on their behalf and start working with some other varieties such as indigenous herbs and the like that have both a superfood and a medicinal value, but most importantly, you know, flavour profiles.
Mr Robertson says they're currently working with both local First Nation groups and the University of Newcastle to find and identify native plants for propagation. While he says it's still a discovery mission to see what is actually viable, he hopes to one day bring these native plants to the mainstream. In the meantime, the business is focusing on employment opportunities to women, youth and First Nations people, including giving them accredited training to operate the automated farming boxes. Currently, the National Farmers Federation estimates Indigenous people only make up about 1% of the farming workforce. Expert in vertical farming Paul Gauthier from the University of Queensland says having Indigenous people involved in farming is incredibly important.
In during my career, one of the things I've done is I've worked in Canada, and I remember very well one of the professors were actually going into the native community in Canada because the knowledge that they had on food and medicine was getting lost because the shaman were disappearing and all this knowledge for curing disease were getting lost because the generation, you know, was not passed on. So I think, you know, the First Nations do have a lot of knowledge to pass on to us. And, you know, we do have a lot of indigenous crops in Australia that for which we only use commercially maybe 50. And so, and we have like more than 2,000. So there's really a lot of opportunities there to look into how to take care of the crop that we have on the land. And especially as we are moving into a very challenged, I would say, environment by climate change, we will need more and more of their knowledge because they have seen way more than we have seen as the knowledge have passed on. And I'm sure they do have some solutions on some crops that they've been growing in the past that they know are very drought resistant or that could be good food and so on. So I think it's critical.
Mr. Robertson is gearing up to launch into the market and is already in discussions with both local businesses and major grocers. But he says success won't be measured on numbers alone.
So the key thing we're trying to showcase here is ESG, environmental social governance. It trumped corporate social responsibility about 3 years ago as a buzzword. That buzzword we love because it's part of our congruence on who we are as a company and what we're trying to do in the marketplace sustainably, productive-wise, but most importantly, showcase that First Nations business are taking their seat at the table to go and help lead the market and be part of a broader supply chain.
Boomer Food founder Corey Robertson ending that report from Lillian Watkins. And you can read more about that story online at the ABC Rural website. It's 24 minutes past 12.
ABC Listen. podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Forestry is a hotly disputed industry in Australia. Environmentalists want to preserve more valuable habitat to protect endangered species, but developers need land for housing. Corporations are looking for carbon sequestration projects, and landholders are trying to make a living from the timber. A panel of forest experts discussed these questions at the inaugural New South Wales Tree Conference and focused for a while on how to attract young people to the industry. On the panel are Emily Cottrell, Director of a consultancy, The Environmental Factor, Rowan Reed, founder of the Master Tree Grower Program at Bambara Agroforestry Farm as well, and Dr. Fabian Jimenez, who is a senior research scientist in forest science with the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries. Host Ashley Bland, the chair of Greening Bathurst and a fellow of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation, asked the panel, starting with Emily, if there are enough young people working in the industry.
I think in general we're finding it hard to find people in all sectors. So young professionals are hard to get hold of, especially medium to experienced professionals who could be out there on the ground spreading the good word. I think resourcing it is really difficult. But again, I know I say this a lot, but you don't know what you don't know. And I think there's a lot of excellent people out there on the land who could make a career out of, you know, moving into one of these professions, whether it's biodiversity or forestry or renewables, and then they don't even know it's a career option. So there are a lot of courses out there, you know, TAFE and universities is a good place to start to look. And then obviously conferences like this where you come and meet people like us and we go, we're hiring. So, you know, there are opportunities.
Well, I think the peer learning models are a real opportunity to expand and farmer networks. And we're seeing, you know, Southern Farming Systems and other groups forming that are building, sharing information about farm practices. And, you know, there's been an inquiry into university education recently, and I think the model isn't functioning well for a lot of areas, particularly for forestry, but even for agriculture and other things. People need new types of learning opportunities and arrangements, and we need mechanisms in which, you know, we want more Indigenous people involved and getting them the right sort of educational opportunities where they're comfortable learning in their way is a whole new kind of area that we need to open up.
I was just talking to someone about the Otway Network earlier today and they're saying what we're doing, and they said, how old's the network? I said, 30 years. But after that 30 years... Now, I'm the youngest of the old people who set this up. There's about 8 or 10 of us involved, and even amongst our mentors, we're older. We're all over 50, some of us over 60. But what's happened now, we ran a Master Tree Grower course, which was it's such a simple idea. We said we're just going to target the young people. They mightn't own land, but they're keen about agriculture. They're the children of the previous tree growers and others. There was 40 or so of these young people, and that was 3 years ago, just before COVID, or just, yeah, whatever that was. This year, they are running the program themselves. There are furniture makers and other craftsmen, and two of them have actually, one built a sawmill, another bought a sawmill. I gave my sawmill to another one, and the promise he's going to make me some furniture. And they've just gone running. They're actually providing the servicing. They're out there doing pruning and thinning on the property. They're doing peer mentoring, getting paid for it by our group. And they keep coming back saying, we're just leaping over your shoulders. You've now built this community up. So you've not only got the trees, you've got the community acceptance and engagement. And they feel like they're just going to take off, that we've built this platform. And it's just so exciting for us old guys about where this is going to go. And I'm enthused because, you know, there's obviously more women involved now than there was when we started, and they've got more ideas, and they're much more entrepreneurial than many of us were.
I just want to, on your comment, you know, if you're a child, why don't you go to university now and do forestry? There's only one undergrad course in Australia, and that's probably in peril as well, so it's not necessarily going to be there. So we may well be in a situation where we don't have any undergrad course possibilities in Australia for forestry at all. And I come from Brazil. Currently, there are over 50 universities in Brazil offering a full degree in forestry, right? So that gives you a sense of perspective. I think there are many factors, and Rod has looked into this for quite a while, but social perception goes a long way as well towards the profession in Australia. You know, coming from Brazil, I was perceived as a tree hugger, basically, by doing forestry in Brazil. And here, when I came, I was worse than a banker. So.
I was at uni when the decline happened. We were booming during the – we had more than 60, 70 students. Over half of them were women. They were really high TER scores, our entry to university. Things were going really well. Then the forestry wars were on the front page of the paper. And it just demoralised it. People just didn't want to be involved in what they saw was the wrong place. And the people who were coming during those 90s were as passionate about probably more passionate about conservation and water production and management. And so we kept on trying to explain, well, forest science is like marine science. Just because the fishing industry is bad, we need scientists around the oceans. People could be comfortable with that, but they couldn't see it related to the forest environment. You were just seen as being a defender of that thing that I saw on the Sunday papers every day, you know, forestry is bad.
Rowan Reed from the Master Tree Grower Program, ending that discussion with host Ashley Bland. A few other people in that broadcast as well. You can listen to the whole 1 hour discussion on forestry on the Big Ideas program on RN on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. It's coming up to 29 minutes to one. Shortly we'll have some weather details, but before we do that, let's find out what's happening in the news. Adam Story, good afternoon.
Afternoon. We've literally just had reports of joint counter-terrorism raids being carried out across various suburbs in Sydney. We haven't been provided the detail of what suburbs or what they're in relation to. However, the police statement says that there is no threat to the public as a result of these operations, and it's not in relation to anything. Anzac Day coming up tomorrow, and any concerns over that. So hopefully we'll have some more details of that through the afternoon. Meanwhile, latest data shows inflation is still rising, prices rising faster than many were expecting. The inflation rate for March was increased to 1%, increased by 1% rather. So that takes the annual, if I can just find the notes on that, I'll be able to tell you what it takes it to.
At least 4%.
I probably shouldn't open my mouth before I start speaking.
I think it's gone up to 4%.
It's 3.6% over the 12 months to March, but under the Reserve Bank's preferred measure of core inflation, they're saying it's more like 4%.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're correct.
So that will mean that interest rates changes will be on hold now.
Well, they're saying there is the slight chance they may actually go up.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Very slight chance. Can't be ruled out.
Right.
Can't be ruled in or out.
Okay. There's known and unknowns.
Meanwhile, new data says that rents are still rising across Australia, but the rate of growth has started slowing. They dropped slightly to 9.1%, so that's about $50 a week. So I suppose you take anything in these circumstances.
At least it's dropping.
There are also reports of rent bidding still going on, despite promises to crack down on that ugly process. Darren Weir, the Melbourne Cup winning jockey, he's been cleared of corruption allegations by the Victorian Racing Tribunal this morning. He was accused of using electronic shock device on racehorses with the intention of corrupting the outcome of the 2018 Melbourne Cup. But the racing stewards says the evidence fell well short of the allegations. And the US Senate has given its final approval for the aid to Ukraine. This is the one that had been blocked in the House of Representatives but finally passed. The measure allocates $95 billion to Ukraine and its two-year-long battle with Russia. It now goes to President Joe Biden for his signature, and he says he will sign it into a law immediately.
Okay. And you would never see that in Australia, where the half of the Democrats and half of the Republicans vote together to get the bill up.
Yes, no.
That's something that you only see that in the United States. You never see that.
It was a rare outbreak of bipartisanship on that one.
It was. Yeah. But you do see it occasionally. But yeah, at that level. Yeah. I mean, where they're half the House.
There was a minority rump that still opposed the whole thing.
Marjorie Taylor Greene. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and her friends. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. All right. Thanks for that, Adam. You'll be back at 1 o'clock and keep us up to date with the latest on that operation.
They sound Sydney. Pretty big. It's pretty rare that in Sydney anyway. We haven't had what they describe as a joint counter-terrorism operation.
So some more details coming later. All right. Thanks, Adam. It's coming up to 25 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. Ed Midlock joins us from the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
So similar conditions over the next few days to what we were talking about yesterday, I guess, sort of sunny conditions in the inland and not much rain around, or maybe a little bit, a few showers in the north.
Yeah, that's right. The cold front we spoke about yesterday is sort of making its way through the inland, sort of halfway through. Forecast to bring some showers to the Hunter Coast and sort of the ranges around there. And then as that pushes to the northeast, it's going to bring showers to the northeast ranges and coastline, mostly, though, concentrated around the coastline for the next few days from Thursday on, well, really until early next week. But behind that front as well, we're looking at temperatures being a lot colder, particularly overnight. We're looking at some frosty areas around the southern ranges starting tomorrow, and that's spreading to the southwest inland all the way to Saturday. So those are some nights of sort of 2-degree minimums, maybe even going into the negatives if you're in some of those higher parts.
Right, okay. And so, yeah, frosty conditions in some parts, and it sounds like it might be quite widespread, but then sunny and warm during the day, is that right?
Yeah, so yeah, those conditions will be sunny during the day and no cloud cover at night, which is going to bring those really cool temperatures overnight.
Right. Any chance of any rain coming up? Any sign of any rain coming maybe next week?
Early next week, we've got another front passing through. At the moment, we're looking at it passing on Tuesday. It's looking like a bit of a moister cold front than the one that's currently passing through the state. That might bring, currently on the forecast, we've got chance of rain in the northern slopes at the moment, just a chance, and we'll be kind of taking more of a look at that over the coming days to see if that gets more likely or less likely, but that's all the way out on Tuesday at this point.
Okay.
So it's sort of in that outlooky period.
But it doesn't sound like there's a lot on the horizon anyway for that, even for that.
Yeah, low chance of not much rain, that's right.
Okay. And not much, nothing beyond that in terms of a big change coming through that you can see on the modelling?
The modelling is not, I mean, past that point, the modelling goes a bit wild and they sort of diverge a little bit, but no, nothing inland, it's just all coastal stuff at the moment.
And it's hard to forecast beyond that 7 days around the autumn period. The models are least reliable around this time of year, aren't they?
Yeah, it's really after 4 days that they start going crazy in autumn. Mm. You can normally get them out to 7 during summer and winter, but in the autumn, yeah, they diverge a bit sooner.
Okay, so yeah, sounds like we're in for that sort of dry weather for quite a while. Maybe a little bit in the north, but doesn't sound like there's too much there either.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks for that, Ed.
Cheers, Michael.
It's 22 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Now, someone's texted in to say that Darren Weir was a trainer, not a jockey. So I'll pass it on to Adam as well to let him know about that. That's from someone who's involved in horse racing. Tim's texted in to say that when you're dealing with Murray Irrigation, they were a government organisation and they've been unable to shake off that bureaucratic attitude. And he says that's why a lot of people are really not interested in putting their hand up to be on the board. They don't like the idea of the sort of corporate style they have, says Tim at Denny. I'm just paraphrasing what he's saying because I probably can't repeat what he was saying on the radio. Someone's texted in, Sherlock's texted in saying Murray Irrigation had a debt of $7 million, so they sold temporary water, which they'd been given by the state government, says Sherlock. Imagine if we all received state assets for free so we could pay our debts each year. He says that we should ask the water minister and the treasurer why they subsidise, why they continue to subsidise irrigators. And there's a few other texts there about Murray Irrigation, so we'll try and get to them a little bit later on. It's coming up to 21 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, Landwatch Australia is a company that's responded to farmer and grazier demands, providing a suite of technology designed to upgrade security and prevent theft on on-farm properties with absentee landholders or on large remote sheep or cattle stations, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. They provide solar-powered cameras, sensing equipment with high resolution that can track and record activities 24/7 over large distances and in remote and rugged country. John Hill is a co-founder of Landwatch Australia. He says the company's grown out of an increasing need to improve farm security and safety and to deter ever-burgeoning farm theft.
Yeah, so Landwatch is a company purely dedicated to keeping an eye on what's important for agriculture in Australia. So we provide solar-powered security cameras and water monitoring cameras in any of the vast landscapes of Australia. And it came about fairly naturally with my brother starting it, just based on a need from one of our close family friends to keep an eye on their property. And it evolved from there, started to sort of snowball with by word of mouth. Every neighbour in the area sort of wanted a camera to keep an eye on things. And obviously just with the sort of security epidemic that's sort of going through outback Australia at the moment, built on from there. And now all of the brothers in my family have joined and become a part of it. And we've employed all our best friends to work in it. And now, yeah, we're just growing from there. But family friends of ours had a big cattle station at Blackall in the middle of Queensland, and we'd holiday there.
Now, you say it grew out of a need. What was the need? People, what, getting having stuff stolen all the time?
Look, initially it was the water. So people just got sick of having to drive a couple of hours every day just to check water. So we put cameras on the water points. And then as things started to get stolen, we realised, hey, there is a need there for security cameras in the outback, just like there is in the city. And obviously putting cameras up in the city is pretty easy because there's 100 different things you can do for it. But when you're on a large acreage property, it gets a bit hard. So that's why we decided to specialise in that, because it's similar technology, but it's just got to be built tougher.
You mean tougher, and I guess connectivity is an issue too.
Massively, yeah. So if you've got a house in town with internet connected, well, adding some cameras on is really easy, just plug and play. But if you're in the middle of a 100,000-acre property and the thought of 4G is laughable, well, then you've got to start to get a bit creative on how you're going to get that connectivity there. So we perfected what we call Landwatch Links, and that's where we can take the internet connection from the house and shoot it 30 k's away into the paddock and have high-speed internet in the paddock then.
30 k's. How do you do that?
Yeah, so it's pretty incredible. It's all based on line of sight, so we have to be able to see it. So we'll usually use a repeater station up on a hill or a big tower somewhere. But what we do, we put a big bit of equipment up there, a device that can shoot it the 30 kilometres. And as long as those two devices can see each other, then that's as good as running a cable.
So, So, and I guess that could be used anywhere, basically, except on hilly country, you know, could be used anywhere. Properties that are relatively in the inside country too.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, and sometimes the hilly country is actually easier because even though it's hilly, usually you've got a couple of points there you could put repeater stations, and then we shoot, say, from the house to the repeater station. We've got line of sight, and then from the repeater station on top of the hill, then we can shoot down to where the camera is. So sometimes the hilly country is actually easier. The big flat country, like around the Riverina, that can sometimes get difficult because it's so flat and so vast that you've got nothing to really mount a repeater station to get the line of sight. So obviously anything over sort of 10 to 15 kilometres, the curve of the earth gets in the way and you can't achieve line of sight anymore. So just having a few hills around is actually pretty handy.
We don't have a flat earth then.
No, I wish we did. It'd make my life a lot easier.
Now, the other thing is this just for absentee landholders, or are you talking about large properties or both, I suppose?
Yeah, definitely both. I think the rise in absentee landholders has definitely increased the need for what we're doing. Obviously, yeah, your single property was enough to support mum and dad, but isn't enough to support the kids and their families as well. So a lot of people are buying those additional properties. And in doing so, they have more travel to get there, and they don't necessarily have eyes on every property. So getting that connectivity and the camera surveillance onto those secondary properties has been really vital.
And what sort of demand has there been?
Just flooded, especially with this on-farm connectivity grant that's happening at the moment. That's really been able to get rid of some of the barriers to adopting ag tech.
That's like $30 million federal government money.
That's the one, yeah. So round one is $15 million. Round two hopefully will be the next $15 million. That's covered 50% of the cost. So someone coming in thinking that I need some cameras on the front gate and around the sheds and around the house, it's going to cost me about $30,000 or so. Well, then all of a sudden that's 15, and that's been a big help to get some people in. Because we find that once they get in, they can experience the technology and experience the benefits of having that surveillance. Well, then they always come back for stage two, stage three. So during this grant, we haven't been pushing them to go all out. We just say, just use the grant to get educated and to trial some technology, whether it's ours or maybe some other gear as well, some water monitoring and devices and stuff like that. use the grant to help experience what ag tech can do for you.
And it's sort of land watch. So it sort of reminds me of that whole idea about neighbourhood watch, but it's not quite like that. It's land watch for like individuals, or is it can be set up like a group as well?
Look, it's funny you say that because we have set up some areas, some communities that have so many cameras of our cameras around the community now that it has sort of become a neighbourhood watch. Like, for example, we had a case out at north of Rockhampton in Queensland, it was, and the big station had a massive telehandler stolen, $200,000 worth of equipment, went walkabout one day, and we were able to jump on, and we looked at the area, and we knew that we had cameras watching roads throughout the entire area, so there was no way that that a truck could get out with a telehandler on the back without us seeing it. So we went through, checked every camera that we had, and we could see, look, this thing has not left the area on a main road. And sure enough, it was found 5K down the road in the bush because everyone knew to look closer to home rather than trying to look in the surrounding towns. So it ended up becoming a bit of a neighbourhood watch because so many people in the area had adopted the technology.
What sort of prosecutions have you seen as a result of this? Any so far?
Look, that's the hard thing. Prosecutions are always difficult to track for two reasons. When we put the cameras in, our big goal is deterrence. We do everything we can to make the cameras as high spec as possible so that if they record something happening, then we've got the good footage. But our real goal is to deter anything from happening at all, and that's been really successful. We've seen a lot of minor things like employees getting caught stealing fuel or someone driving out with a few extra bales of hay on the back of their ute than they meant to. But generally speaking, most of our cameras have done their job in deterring anything from being stolen at all. Unfortunately, that's meant that everyone's gone next door. Yeah, it's all about target hardening, which is a term the police use to make it more difficult for someone to steal your stuff. So if someone's driving around up and down the road and they see, okay, this guy's got cameras, but next door doesn't, well, obviously they're going to hit next door.
John Hill is a co-founder of Land Watch Australia, and they've also set up a company in the United States now. It's 14 minutes to one.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. Federal Minister for Women, Katie Gallagher, says the rate of violence against women is a crisis. You'll hear from a lawyer working on the front line in regional New South Wales. The latest inflation figures are out today. What picture do they paint of the state of the economy? And buy and bury Donald Trump's criminal trial. Here's from a controversial former publisher. Those stories and more from right across the country and around the globe coming up on The World Today.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Protecting the future of the Murray-Darling Basin involves addressing threats posed to the system from climate change. That's according to 10 water experts who have contributed to a series of essays from the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering. The series warns of threats to communities, the environment and agriculture, with the basin having warmed by 1 degree since 1910. Report co-editor Dr. Therese Flapper explains that the series provides a 50-year vision of the basin.
The premise was and purpose was definitely around thinking broadly across the challenges and stresses and opportunities that the basin represents, particularly with the lens of climate change and in that long-term view of 50 years. And so the suite of essays come from a range of areas that include hydroclimate information, water quality, quantity, ecosystems, irrigation, agriculture, and the economics. And it was the first time that we're aware of that such a vast array of the different challenges have been discussed with a 50-year horizon. And so for each essay, they talk about why it matters from that lens, what different scenarios in the future might look like, and what adaptations and opportunities do we have now to enact something to have a secure, beautiful future for the basin in 50 years' time.
One of the things that have really prompted some of the essays in the collection is a concern about, in the original Water Act from 2007, a lack of addressing of climate change in the development of that act?
Yeah, definitely. It wasn't really a consideration at that time. And since then, it's become a more and more evidenced an increasing concern, of course, and a lens, but those updates haven't really come through. At the moment, we are making submissions also to the Productivity Commission interim report on a new national water initiative. We made a submission also to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan Review and also to Minister Plibersek's current discussion paper on a future national water agreement. Now, some of those go beyond the basin, but the principles are still the same, and that consideration of climate change, population growth, resilient communities where we partner and support them as they transition to a different future is fundamental to what these plans and policies in government for implementation need to be in the future. So it's been a bit stagnant for a while. The release of this work is timely given the 2026 review of the Basin Plan, and we certainly hope that those that are looking to do those updates will consider evolving it to have some agreement around requiring climate change and long-term 50-year impact modelling, include integrated land and water management strategies, and enhance the government and governance stakeholder representation with many different types of stakeholders. And we'd like to see that all based on a robust risk assessment framework, including environment social governance type principles and frameworks as well.
And it's interesting that you note for some of these recommendations, reinstating and reintroducing some different bodies. Do you know why these were removed or scuttled in the first place?
Well, it seems to be the political landscape, and whilst that can be quite challenging, I think what we really need to call for is that it is bipartisan, and bipartisan in all jurisdictions. So when you have each state, territory and the Commonwealth that have 3 or 4 year cycles with different jurisdictional pressures, which are all absolutely reasonable, those reinstatements and re-establishments are often assigned with other priorities and pressures that the government have been facing. So we need a 50-year vision and commitment from all basin jurisdictions to this.
Have you had much interest so far from stakeholders in government or involved with the basin at this stage in this series?
Yes, we have had some. Would have liked to perhaps have a little more. Some areas have had the embargoed copy for a while now, and we haven't heard a lot from them just yet. But as you know, that's probably also to do with the timing of the current Murray-Darling Basin Plan Review, the timing of the Productivity Commission's report to the Commonwealth on the National Water Initiative, and Minister Plibersek's work on a discussion paper for a new National Water Agreement as well.
That's Dr. Therese Flapper, the co-editor of the Thriving Murray-Darling Basin in 50 Years. It's a climate change series, and she was speaking there with Eliza Berlage. We've had a text in asking about the minimum spend to qualify for the connectivity grant that we were just talking about in the previous story with Landwatch. The minimum spend, Brian, in Narrabri is $3,000. We just looked it up on the government website. It's time for markets. First up, let's go to casino cattle.
Good afternoon. The short week saw numbers reduced for a yarding of 400 head, consisting mainly of young cattle and 170 cows. Quality was fairly mixed in a cheaper market, with not all the regular buyers present. Restocker weaner steers sold from 216 to 364 cents. Restocker weaner heifers 176 to 266. Feelers to process range from 216 to 265 cents. There was insufficient numbers of grown steers and heifers for a reliable quote. Cow market was irregular, with 2 score selling from 150 to 174 cents, 3 and 4 score cows 174 to 202. This is Doug Robson at Casino.
Let's go to Carcor sheep and lambs now.
Numbers remain similar to last week with 4,600 lambs penned. Quality was mixed with mainly trade weights penned with limited store types. There were good runs of heavy trade weights which were eagerly sought after. Not all the regular buyers were present. Lightweight processing lambs to 18 kilos gained $15, selling from 60 to 110. Trade lambs 20 to 24 kilos were also 15 dirha. They sold between 122 and 176. Heavyweight lambs over 24 kilos were 6 dirha, 177 to 212. The best of the hoggets reached 130. There were 1,900 mixed quality mutton yarded, where prices were $15 to $20 stronger. Merino ewes sold from $15 to $90. Crossbred ewes, $55 to $116. Merino weathers reached $68 and crossbreds $80. Rams sold to $20. This has been Angus Williams for MLA at CTLX.
Let's go to Yass Sheep and Lambs now, and Graham Richard.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 3,350. The quality remains mixed with plenty of light and secondary trade lambs. There was a small run of trade lambs with a good fat cover and a limited supply of heavyweights. The market sold to stronger trends with gains of $9 to $12 on the light lambs and trades gaining $13 to $16. The heavy lambs were firm. Light two-score processing lambs, 55 to 116. The trade weights, 20 to 22 kilos, 135 to 152, 22 to 24, 148 to 168, and they averaged 680 cents, with the best out to 725 cents for second cross lambs. 24 to 26, 169 to 198. The best of the hoggets reached 135. Mutton numbers eased to 3,450. The quality remains mixed, but prices lifted 10 to 13. The mini weight ewes, 37 to 88. Heavy crossbreds reached 99 and merinos $100. Most average between 275 and 290 cents. And this has been Graham Richard.
Thanks, Graham. Let's go to Cowra Sheep and Lambs now. And Rob Pearce, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. There were 2,500 lambs down by 200. Quality improved for the trade and heavyweights. There were mainly trade and heavies pen stores were limited in supply. Medium and heavy trades were 2 to 7 dearer. 20 to 22 kilos, 143 to 146. 23 to 24, 154 to 175. Averaging 650 to 675 cents. Heavyweights were 8 to 15 dearer. 24 to 26, 172 to 176. 26 plus, 181 to a top of 246.20. Averaging 660 to 695 cents. And mutton numbers fell for only 350, quality was mixed, prices lifted 10, heavy first cross ewes sold from 88 to 95, averaging 265 cents. This has been Rob Pearce from MLA at Cowra.
Thanks, Rob. Let's go to Mossvale Cattle now with the details. Here's David Kent.
Good afternoon, Michael. There was a yarding of 942 good quality cattle, including some outstanding runs of prime burlers reaching 408 cents, along with some high yielding yearlings to process, topping at 386. Weaners returning the paddock were well supplied and there were 120 cows. The return of a feedlot buyer and some keen interest from restockers contributed to an increase in prices. Trade yearlings considerably dearer, steers 270 to 386, heifers 240 to 380. Feeder steers lifted 12, medium weights 318 to 365, over 400 kilos 280 to 352. Restocker weaner steers 20 dearer, 258 to 396. The heifer portion mostly firm, 170 to 290. Heavy grain steers 9 better, 190 to 310. Cows, price unchanged, 2 and 3 scores, 155 to 205. Heavy prime cows, 196 to 225 cents per kilo. This is David Kent at Mossvale from LA.
Thanks for that, David. Let's go to Singleton Cattle now and Angus Barlow.
Good afternoon. Rainfall totals of 25 to 40 millimetres last weekend combined with two big sales last week saw Singleton Agents Yard 286 cattle. A very mixed yarding, quality varied from excellent to plain, most of the regular buyers active, along with the odd new local restocker order. Restocker steer weaners 11 to 30 cents cheaper, selling between 182 and 360. Over 330 kilos traded dearer by 24, selling from 298 to 328, with the best local butcher calf making 348. Light restocker heifer weaners held firm to dearer, 170 to 288, with the best light calf to the trade making 300. Best butcher calf over 330 kilos made up to 336. Light two-score cows up by 2 to 6 cents, 148 to 172. Prime heavy 3 and 4-score cows 11 cents cheaper, 200 to 216. Angus Barlow for MLA at Singleton.
Talking about Singleton, we'll be broadcasting an outside broadcast from of the country from Singleton on Thursday, and then Friday we'll be at Tokau for their 40th anniversary field days. It's coming up to 1 minute to one.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
And that's the program for today. We'll be back tomorrow between 12 and 1 on Anzac Day, so no rest for the wicked, but got some pretty interesting packages, talking to some old diggers as well, so stay tuned to the Country Hour tomorrow between 12 and 1 for that.